From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Nicolas Maduro has been declared winner of Sunday's presidential election in Venezuela. An election boycotted by the opposition with a turnout of just over 30%. With more than 90% of the votes counted, Mr. Maduro received just under 68%, with his main rival Henri Falcón making up 21%. Washington Office on Latin America analyst Jeff Ramsey said despite Mr. Maduro's get-out-the-vote effort, only 30% of those eligible cast ballots.
The government is holding these elections despite all the international condemnation of the conditions under which they're being held because it wants to achieve some kind of legitimacy domestically. The low turnout, even among Chavista voters, really put a hole in that plan.
The Venezuelan leader called the election a year early and was widely expected to win re-election despite widespread economic hardship and international isolation. As for additional international sanctions,
we are likely to see international pressure ratchet up on Venezuela. One thing in particular that concerns me is recent remarks by Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan, in which he threatened that the United States is considering leveling oil sanctions.
Ramsey said that could really add to the hardships of the Venezuelan people. The U.S. Sunday signaled it would not recognize the outcome of the election. The Burundian Electoral Commission says results of Thursday's referendum on constitutional reforms that could leave President Pierre Nkurunziza in power for another 15 years are expected to be released Monday. The opposition indicated it cannot accept the result. Friday, it appeared clear the referendum sided with Mr. Nkurunziza. Critics allege that delay in release of the results means the government is massaging the figures to fit the official narrative. Mr. Nkurunziza has been in power since 2005, sparked political violence in 2015 by announcing his intention to seek a third term. This is VOA News. The U.S. and China have agreed to back away from a tariff war and reached an understanding on reducing the U.S. trade imbalance. Following 2 days of talks in Washington, China promised to buy more U.S. goods. Larry Kudlow, chief economic advisor to President Donald Trump, appeared on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday.
Our view is China must open up. They must become fair traders. They have not been. The rest of the world knows they have not been. And China has got to stop the theft of intellectual property and the forced transfer of technology. Those are our family jewels. Mm-hmm. And we can make deals on this. I believe we can make arrangements. That has not yet been completed.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is expected to travel to Beijing soon to negotiate China's commitment to buy more U.S. goods to reduce the trade deficit with Beijing, which last year totaled $375 billion. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin Sunday said the U.S. cares more about getting a good agreement than quickly concluding the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, with Mexico and Canada. He appeared on the Fox News program Sunday.
I've been in contact with the finance ministers in both Canada and Mexico. President Trump and Trudeau had a very good conversation last week. As Ambassador Lighthizer has said, we're still far apart, but we're working every day to renegotiate this agreement, and that's what we're focused on.
An informal deadline came and went for reaching an updated deal for the 24-year NAFTA agreement for Congress to approve it before November's election. Iraq Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose political bloc came in first in last week's parliamentary elections, met with the leader of a pro-Iran bloc Sunday about forming a government. No party won an outright majority, so political negotiations could drag on for weeks or months. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has been hospitalized in the West Bank a third time in a week. The 83-year-old Abbas underwent minor ear surgery and returned Sunday for medical tests after complaining of a fever. An Egyptian television series being shown during the Muslim holy month Ramadan has angered Sudan. It depicts some Egyptians in Sudan involved in terrorism. The Sudanese Foreign Ministry summoned the Egyptian ambassador to complain of a negative stereotype image, insisting no Egyptian in Sudan has been involved in terrorism. Grieving parents, families, and friends Sunday mourned the loss of 10 people killed in a shooting rampage in Santa Fe, Texas. Texas Governor Greg Abbott was on hand at the service at the Arcadia First Baptist Church. Texas officials charged a 17-year-old with capital murder. Cubans held funeral services Sunday for the first of the victims of Friday's plane crash in which 110 died, the Caribbean island's worst air disaster in nearly 30 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
We'll be right back. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, May 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is Ebola Vaccination Day in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We are going to start the vaccination in Bandaka. We are going to start with healthcare workers because they've been exposed. They are in the front line and they're putting their lives at risk to save people.
Dr. Ole Ilunga is the health minister of the DRC. Killings and kidnappings mar Sunday's Cameroon National Day celebrations. Liberia's information minister disputes claims of tension between President George Weah and his vice president. Women activists in East Africa warn against violence against women, and Burundi's opposition says it will challenge in court constitutional amendment referendum results expected today.
There is intimidation. There are people who have been forced to vote not willingly. Some others have been forced even to hide because a campaign of intimidation and arrest.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of Burundi's main opposition party, and the U.S. government sanctions a close associate of exiled Gambian leader Yahya Jammeh. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, Monday, is Ebola Vaccination Day in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the latest outbreak of the disease has reportedly killed 26 people. Health Minister Ole Ilunga says an experimental vaccine once used in West Africa during the biggest recorded Ebola outbreak from 2014 to 2016 will be administered first to health workers in the port city of Mbandaka because they are on the front line of the fight against the disease.
We are going to start the vaccination in Bandaka. We are going to start with healthcare workers because they've been exposed. They are in the front line and they're putting their lives at risk to save people.
How many cases altogether have been confirmed by your ministry?
We have so far only 22 cases confirmed with the virus Ebola. The other are either probable cases or suspected cases.
Doctor, the way I understand it is that this vaccine is a new one and it has yet to officially be licensed for human use. Is there a concern that there may be some risk associated with this?
No, I think that the effectiveness of the vaccine has been already proved. And the safety as well during the outbreak in West Africa. And it was tested there, and all the people who got the vaccine during the incubation phase didn't develop the disease. So for us, it's an effective vaccine. I think that they are just waiting the approval for commercialization, but the effectiveness in the humankind has been proved. On top of that, our ethical committee and the scientific committee of the university have given us the green light to use the vaccine.
This Ebola outbreak, this latest one, we understand, is the ninth since the disease made its first appearance in the 1970s. Does your government know what is causing it, how it comes about in your country?
No, you have to know that the eradication of the Ebola virus is a challenge for all the scientific community. So far, we think that we will continue to have epidemics of Ebola in DRC. Because so far, it's a natural virus, and we don't know yet all the details about the replication model, spreading model of the virus. So I think that in the coming years, we will still be continue to have epidemics in DRC, just as in the U.S. and other countries in the world, people continue to have a flu epidemic and influenza epidemic, because even when you know the causes of a disease, it doesn't mean that you can control the causes. But what has changed now is the fact that we have a vaccine. When there is an outbreak, we can stop the spreading of the outbreak with the vaccine. I think that's a breakthrough.
Because there's been this notion that maybe people get Ebola from something by eating certain meat or so. Is there a scientific justification for that?
No, not at all. Not at all. We think that the reservoir is somehow in the forest, but nobody knows what causes the occurrence of outbreaks. As I say, it's a challenge for the scientific community to help us to better understand the disease and the causes of an outbreak. So far, we don't know yet.
Dr. Ole Ilunga is the health minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Results from last Thursday's Burundi constitutional referendum are expected today, Monday. If passed, President Pierre Nkurunziza will remain in power until 2034. As Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, opposition leader Agathon Rwasa says he will challenge the results in court because the referendum was marred by intimidation, including people being forced to vote.
According to the preliminary results, the yes vote, which supports the amendment of the constitution, leads in almost all of the 18 provinces in the country. Agathon Rwasa, a Burundi opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the parliament who campaigned against the amendment, said that if the electoral commission announces the result, his party will go to court.
The poll didn't respect the rules which are there in the electoral court. There is intimidation. There are people who have been forced to vote not willingly. Some others have been forced even to hide because a campaign of intimidation, arrest, and even after, people are still persecuted just because they voted either no or they are just suspected to have been voting no.
Human Rights Watch released a statement indicating that Burundi Security Services and the ruling party members killed, raped, abducted, beat, and intimidated suspected opponents in the months leading up to the constitutional referendum. Ida Soya, Central African Director at Human Rights Watch, said that Burundi government officials and Imbonerakure clearly knew there would be no penalty for their violence against real and perceived opponents to allow Nkurunziza and CNDD-FDD to maintain their grip on power. Martin Nivyabandi is the Burundi Human Rights Minister.
Sometimes through international organizations are claiming to be a human rights defenders, and the Human Rights Watch, sometimes they release report issues without insulting the point of view of the government.
Hatungimana Modest is one of the voters who think it was high time the country amended the constitution. She says that she feels very good after voting because Burundians voted for their future. She says she believes that the new constitution will unite Burundians and build trust in the communities. As the draft constitution is expected to be approved by majority of the Burundians, major changes beyond the presidential term limit are expected to be made. Article 50 of the draft constitution states that the right of asylum is recognized under the conditions defined by the law and that no Burundian can be extradited. Burundi was the first African country to withdraw from the International Criminal Court, with the Burundi government officials accused of the crimes against humanity since 2015. The draft constitution, if approved, is expected to protect them from being extradited and convicted on the accused crimes. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Several policemen have been killed, soldiers wounded, and mayors kidnapped in Cameroon by suspected armed separatists who had warned against celebrating the country's National Day in the English-speaking regions. It is the day in 1972 when Cameroonians voted for a unitary state against the then federal system. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, President Paul Biya led the celebrations along with a contingent of Nigerian soldiers that has been helping in the fight against the Boko Haram insurgency in Cameroon.
A Nigerian military contingent sings before Cameroon President Paul Biya, cabinet ministers, diplomats, and thousands of people during the National Day parade in Yaoundé. Nigerian Lieutenant Colonel Mokhtar Sani Daroda says they were invited by Biya to participate as recognition for their fight against the Boko Haram insurgency that has left 25,000 people dead and more than 2.6 million displaced in Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger.
The Guards Brigade is the elite brigade that carries out national functions on behalf of the Nigerian Army, and they also provide security of the presidency and the entire federal capital city, and they have been selected to participate in one of the parades we hold in very high esteem. A very special crop to take part in your parade.
But tensions flared in many towns and villages of Cameroon's English-speaking regions, including Konye, Batibe, a corner and several villages. At least two policemen and several people were killed.
I am Eku Oje Simon, the mayor of Bangem Council.
In a recording provided by suspected separatists, Mayor Eku Simon of Bangem, an English-speaking town in southwest Cameroon, says he was kidnapped with his deputy for distributing uniforms for residents to march in National Day ceremonies, despite the separatist-called boycott. He says he is held by Ambazonia Restoration Forces. Ambazonia is what separatists call their self-declared republic in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Norbert Ngu says he escaped Saturday from Ekona to Yaoundé when armed separatists started shooting to stop people from celebrating National Day. He says his house was attacked.
Some boys saw my father inside the house, attacked my father. I lost my father because of this crisis.
Bia's government had asked people to come out in numbers to celebrate National Day as a sign of unity. Tensions in Cameroon began in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers protested, saying they were frustrated with the dominance of the French language and the marginalization of the Anglophone population. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Monday, May 21st. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Women activists are warning that acts of violent crimes, especially against women, will intensify in East Africa unless security forces double their efforts. Sheila Kawamara, the executive director of the Eastern African Subregional Support Initiative for the Advancement of Women, says recent killings in East Africa, particularly Uganda, have instilled fear among the population. But the deputy police spokesman, Patrick Oyango, says security forces are doing all they can to resolve these murders. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch files this report from Kampala.
While addressing journalists in Kampala this past Friday, Kawamara implored East African governments to come up with measures that will help reduce rampant women death in the region.
We are very concerned that our leaders are shockingly silent while women are massively being killed while giving birth as a result of targeted killings and kidnaps, and also some being killed for ritual sacrifices and others brutally murdered in areas affected by conflicts, particularly before, during, and after elections or referendums.
Kawamara blames security organs for not doing enough to protect women. For example, Kawamara says more than 100 women were gruesomely killed in Uganda in the past year alone. One of the gruesome murders that shocked Uganda this year was that of Kampala resident Susan Magara, whose kidnappers demanded for over 3 billion Uganda shillings, or about $1 million in ransom, before eventually killing her. Uganda police deputy spokesman Patrick Onyango says the security organs are doing all they can to ensure that both people and property are secure. He also says some suspects have been arrested and charged before the courts of law.
The women themselves are faking their own kidnap. There is a lady, a woman in Mbarara, who faked her own kidnap because she had problems of paying loan. So she wanted the relative to pay for her the loan and fake her own kidnap. There is a woman whom we have just rescued from Entebbe who also faked her own kidnap, avoiding other things.
ES is a coalition of women rights NGOs and networks in the 8 East African countries: Burundi, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Somalia, Tanzania, and Uganda. Another sector that she says the governments have unfortunately abandoned or neglected is health.
The maternal mortality rates are alarmingly high across the region, with Burundi at 712 deaths per 100,000 live births. Tanzania is at 432 women dying out of every 100,000 live births. Kenya is 362, Uganda at 360, and Rwanda at 210. These rates are unacceptable.
Women activists also want the governments to empower women financially by easing access to credit facilities, fight gender-based violence, and promote girl-child education. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Liberia Information Minister Eugene Nambwe says the condition of the country under President George Weah is great despite some economic challenges. His comment comes at a time that some say President Weah has been building personal new houses and renovating others, something critics say, if true, does not match the government's pro-poor agenda. The comment also comes at a time that some say the government has not paid public sector workers since December last year. Mr. Nambwe also denies there is a rift between President Weah and Vice President Joel Howard Taylor after the vice president left the country without informing the president about her trip in line with protocol. He said the vice president has since apologized to President Weah on national radio.
The working condition between both of them is very harmonious and cordial. The vice president herself went on radio, in a very mature way to say that, look, I traveled out of the country. I did not inform the president in keeping with normal protocol. And therefore, she informed the public that she had apologized. So we move on. You know, there is no rift. The president is the president. The vice president is the vice president. And they continue to work together to bring about the development that we promised the people of Liberia. And this is what the government is focused on. But I must also say, James, that, we've just less than 5 months into this administration. It is unusual that all of those who predicted that the government will fail, they made even previous predictions that the president will not even win the elections, they are still in campaign mode. So every step of the way, even things that are normal, you know, when the government interacts with its citizens, they find a way to skew it and make it look like there is a national crisis. You know, the state of the nation is great. Yes, we have some economic difficulties, but the president is taking the right decisions now so that at the end of the day, we can see the benefits of this decision.
Mr. Minister, there are people who say that President Weah, after taking office, has been either building new houses or renovating old ones. If that's the case, how does that square up with your administration's poor agenda?
Poor means the government will take action, and in its activities, we will do things that will positively affect the poor people and will take them away from poverty. We have started doing that. So yes, the government is pro-poor. Look at how we recast the budget, made some savings, and apply those savings to some of the projects that have direct impact on the poor people. Now, the fact that the president is continuing a project that he started even before he became president, he hasn't acquired any new property. Even before and during the elections, the president had been renovating his property on 9th Street. That was a contract that he signed prior to becoming president.
On the issue of the public sector salaries, I've also read some things that you have not paid public sector employees since December. What's the truth?
It's absolutely not true that this government has not paid civil servants and other public sector workers. In fact, we are very up to date with the salary payment for all workers. One of the things we also did was to cut down, you know, these ghost names that were on government payroll. Amongst those names were names of some doctors who were interns previously and have now gotten their full tenure. So there was some amount of misunderstanding. So the Medical and Dental Association threatened a strike. The government engaged them fully. We had several days of comprehensive engagement, and I think we have found a resolution. This is why no strike occurred.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. You are speaking with me from the capital of Monrovia. The U.S. government has sanctioned a close associate of exiled Gambian leader Yahya Jammeh. Businessman Mohamed Bazzi is accused of drug trafficking, money laundering, and funneling millions of dollars to the Lebanon-based Hezbollah terrorist group. As viewed Pandarium by reports, Gambian Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadu says the government will enforce the U.S. sanctions to the letter.
Mohamed Bazzi, a former close associate of dictator Yahya Jammeh, has found himself in double jeopardy. After having his assets and businesses frozen by the Gambian government, the U.S. government has also imposed sanctions against the Lebanese businessman. The U.S. Treasury Department has designated Mr. Bazzi as a key financier of the Hezbollah terrorist group. Bazzi operates businesses in Belgium, Lebanon, Iraq, and several West African countries, including the Gambia. The U.S. Treasury Department says Bazzi has over the years provided millions of dollars to Hezbollah from his illicit business activities. Abubakar Tambadu is Gambia's justice minister. He says the U.S. sanctions has further consolidated Gambia's case against Bazzi.
the commission's actions to restrain Mohamed Bazi from disposing of his assets in the country and pending the conclusion of the commission of inquiry into the financial dealings of the former president is justified. It shows that Mohamed Bazi is a person of interest, of continued interest in the government of the Gambia.
Mr. Bazi has business ties with the Ironman Joma drug trafficking and money laundering organization, according to the Treasury Department. This is Pan Derimbai reporting.
Time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the unveiling of Lothar Matthäus as an ambassador of Morocco's bid for the 2026 edition of Football Showpiece, the World Cup. Lothar Matthäus, who captained West Germany to victory at the 1990 World Cup in Italy, has expressed his delight in supporting Morocco 2026, promoting what is described as an authentic, inclusive and responsive bid. Lothar Matthäus won the FIFA World Player of the Year award in 1991, the European Player of the Year award in 1990 and the German Footballer of the Year award in both 1990 and 1999. And ahead of the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia, Super Eagles assistant coach Salisu Adamu says Nigeria is not unaware of the opposition the Super Eagles will face at the World Cup with the likes of Argentina in the same group. But the coach is confident that the West African football powerhouse could pull up some surprises.
Yeah, we are in a very difficult group. Because we were playing Iceland, they came first in the European group. Argentina always top at that level. And Croatia, a very good footballing nation. But I think all the four teams have the chance to qualify to score up.
Staying with the Super Eagles, South Africa Chippa United number one goalkeeper Daniel Akpeyi is heading to Russia to represent Nigeria. The Nigerian is hoping to fight for the number one shirt alongside three other goalkeepers at the Super Eagles when the camp opens later this week. Before he left South Africa, he told reporters that it was an honor to represent the Nigerian national team.
For a very long time, Africa nation teams have not actually been going that far, but I think with the momentum which we started the period of the qualifiers to the World Cup, I'm sure if we keep that momentum, we're actually going to go that far, probably beyond the quarterfinal to semifinal.
Staying with football news, Egyptian football powerhouse Al Ahly have confirmed that they are in talks with European and South American coaches. The Al Ahly coaching job became vacant after Hassan Al-Badari resigned following a 2-0 defeat to Ugandan side KCCA FC in the 2018 CAF Champions League Group A game. On Tuesday, the Cairo Giants have revealed that six tacticians from Argentina, Brazil, Czech Republic, Holland, Serbia, and Portugal are keen to replace the Egyptian coach. And the long-awaited Ethiopian Football Federation elections will now take place on the 3rd of June 2018 in Semira, Afar. Newly constituted EFF Electoral Committee set the date for both presidential and executive committee polls. The elections have been postponed five times in the past, with the bone of contention being perceived biased composition of the key bodies charged with conducting the process. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butt in Washington, saying have a good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important after-news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.